If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Minute Productions presents Guide for the Film Fanatic, the podcast where we invite a guest to pick one movie from Danny Perry's seminal 1986 film reference book and talk to us about that movie. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Ho.
Our guest today, friends, is a pop culture critic and writer beloved for his work at the AV Club, The Dissolve, and his websites, Nathan Rabin's Happy Place and Nathan Rabin's Bad Ideas. He is also the author of several books, including My Year of Flops, The Big Rewind, You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me, The Joy of Trash, The Weird Accordion to Al, and I fucked it up, and Weird Al the Book with Weird Al Yankovic. His latest book is The Fractured Mirror, Nathan Rabin's Happy Place's definitive guide to American movies about filmmaking. Please welcome the delightful, the insightful Mr. Nathan Rabin. Hi, Nathan.
Hello. It is a delight and a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on. First of all, usually we start with the plug. We're going to do the plug second. I know you had a very scary car accident a few months back. A lot of people very worried about you. So I'm starting there. How's your health? How's your recovery? How you feeling?
I'm doing really well. I've actually been in physical therapy for the last month and a half, which has been kind of fascinating. and yeah, it's just weird. Sometimes like people ask me about it and I'll be like, what are you talking about?
Right.
Like, oh yeah, I was in a horrible car accident 3 months ago. Yeah, on Thanksgiving. We were pulling into our cul-de-sac where we live and then boom, I totally got hit by a car. And I was the one who like took all the impact. I was the martyr. I was like, I will suffer so that my family can be safe.
Right.
I totally planned it that way. And like looking at my phone and then I heard this sonic boom. And then I was in excruciating pain. I broke my ribs and I punctured my lung and I had over $100,000 in hospital bills in just 5 days.
Wow.
God bless the American medical system.
Yeah, greatest healthcare system in the world. Yeah.
Why would we want to do anything else?
Why? Why would we?
So well.
Exactly.
So I was in a car wreck, sort of in the same way that Billy, the trial of Billy Jack. and Billy Jack Goes to Washington are both a total train wrecks and car wrecks and utterly fascinating.
Before we do that, let's do plug. Tell us a bit about The Fractured Mirror and how it came to be.
Sure. Goodness, this was about 4 or 5 years ago. I had just finished The Weird Accordion to Al, the book that's impossible to say the name of
It
correctly.
was. It was. Just had
Before
a
that, it was
live demo of that. Yeah.
yeah. Before that, was You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me.
Right.
Was the other book title that was very, very difficult, even me, to get correctly. And The Weird Accordion to Al had a spin-off called The Weird A Coloring. To Al, that was a coloring book
Very
by the
good.
guy who worked on the illustrations for my book, and in Felipe Cibrero. I think that's his right name there. But he's like a lot of people and that who works with me who have become much more successful than me over the course of our collaboration. Like, he's doing
Sure.
fantastic. He just did like the Blues Brothers graphic novel. He did
Wow.
the art for that. Yeah, he's his career is on fire. The Toxic Avenger, and he just did these amazing illustrations for The Weird Accordion to Al. And while I was gazing adoringly at The Weird Accordion to
Right.
Al, I would like doodle in sort of the illustrations and like, this there's kind of a coloring book in this.
Sure.
And I was right, and it's really, really yeah, that's sold thousands of copies and delighted
Yay.
children alike. And then I was writing this column for TCM Backlot, the
Okay.
late beloved TCM Backlot. And yeah, I had this wonderful, wonderful editor named Yaakov Friedman, and I had two columns for him. One was called First and Last, that sort of dealt with the first and final films of prominent filmmakers. And I had a really hard time finding entries for that because, like, a lot of the first films or the last films are obscure and out of date and impossible to watch. Because a lot of times, yeah, the first ones are too old or too obscure. And then the last ones are too sad and too obscure. But I also had The Fractured Mirror, which was about movies about movies. So it's always something that kind of fascinated me. And I came to fall back in love with cinema writing that. So I said to Yakov, when TCM Backlot, like all publications that try and do good work, went out of business,
Of
I
course.
said, "Hey, can I run these articles on my website?" And he said, "Sure, yeah, go on ahead." And then I said, "Can I write a book about it as well?" And I thought I would write the book in about a year and a half, and it would be about 300 movies or so. It ended up taking me 4.5 years to write this book, and there are over 500 entries in it. I kind of went insane.
Yeah.
I have autism and ADHD, so this kind of became my insane hyper focus.
Sure.
And it's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger until I'm like, this is so incredibly daunting that I might never finish this book, which my brain is like, that's a great idea, then you'll never have to deal with consequences. And then the friend's like, no, you need to stop this. Like, this needs to exist. You can't just keep on
Sure.
working on this book for decades and decades and decades. So I watched every single narrative film about filmmaking released within the last 100 years or so before it. 1923, not a whole lot remains. The whole silver nitrate
Sure.
stuff, it all went kablooey.
Sure.
And then, yeah, then I got Joe Dante to write the foreword for it, which was an incredible honor, especially considering that he directed Matinee
One of the great
and
movies about movies, yeah.
and Hollywood Boulevard, sort of
Oh,
his
yeah.
again, like one of the great, sort of
Yeah.
modern comedies, one of the very meta. So that was an incredible honor. And then, yeah, Felipe Cervero, he did the illustrations for them as well. And it's funny because like he finished like 4 months after we started,
Right.
and then I finished like 4.5 years later.
Well, the book is terrific. I heartily recommend it. We'll plug it again at the end. But we're to your credit, we are not talking about a movie that is in the book, which a lot of times when someone's coming on to plug, they want to plug all the way through. So what film, you mentioned it in passing, what film did you select to discuss with us today?
I chose a motion picture called Billy Jack.
I just go berserk.
That
This is what
that
it's
is how
all
you start a
about.
trailer.
And Billy Jack.
Berserk. Like, I mean, that they know what they're selling. They're selling it to you right off the bat. We're gonna throw some people through windows and have some kids on a school bus. That's really the movie in a nutshell. That's the movie in 10 seconds. Kicking
They're
people in the
talking about
face
Billy Jack. You
and
do something about the
singing
lawyer,
hippie songs
what's gonna happen
on
to
a
my husband?
husband. That's kind of
this is why they're talking about Billy Jack.
That is what it is.
Barefoot in the park.
There's such a place where they really care about another and really love each other. Now you tell me what such a place is, and I promise you that I'll never hurt another.
He got excited in this scene. That's got to be the most. Even when he's getting shot at, he didn't get as excited as he did.
Billy Jack.
When he's telling that lady that the world is terrible and he can't fix it. And that's it. That's the whole trailer. That's the shortest 1971 trailer I think we've seen.
I mean, the thing about them is they're always either 54 seconds like this one or 3 minutes and 54 seconds. There is no middle ground on your 70s trailers. So Billy Jack is a 1971 martial arts social drama, an odd combination to be sure. Starring Tom Laughlin, who also directed, produced, and co-wrote under three different pseudonyms. It was co-written also under a pseudonym by his wife, Dolores Taylor, who co-stars. And honestly, its production history would frankly make for a good movie itself, one that could have gone into Nathan's new book. Larry Karaszewski, I know you sometimes listen. I'd like to, it's a modest pitch, but the Billy Jack movie, I know you guys would crush. Billy Jack was first introduced, the character was first introduced in the 1967 exploitation movie Born Losers. Made a lot of money for American International Pictures, which was the initial financier of this follow-up. But Laughlin halted filming and bought back the picture when he grew frustrated by their suggestions. 20th Century Fox stepped in. This will be a recurring theme in his career. 20th Century Fox stepped in with the rest of the money, but during post-production, he grew frustrated with their suggestions. So he stole the soundtrack and held it hostage until Fox agreed to sell the picture back to him. He then shopped it around and made a distribution deal with Warner Brothers, but he was dissatisfied with their distribution strategy, which basically dumped the movie into grindhouses and drive-ins, and began to market the film himself, separate from their efforts. His campaign was so successful that he sued the studio to the tune of $51 million for misrepresenting their marketing and distribution intentions. They settled out of court and re-released the movie in May of 1973 with a new advertising campaign, and it became one of that year's biggest
hits. God, you know he was insufferable.
He was just
like, I was right all along.
Yes.
You know he was
Take
insufferable.
That, Warner Brothers. Yeah. All right, Mike, what does Danny Perry say about Billy Jack in Guide for the Film Fanatic?
Danny says,
Tom Laughlin introduced us to his title character, a half-breed, a Hapkido expert, a former Green Beret and war hero in Vietnam, in 1967 successful biker film, Born Losers. This time, the protector of the downtrodden protects the troubled children who live at the alternative school of his girlfriend, Dolores Taylor. Due to canny marketing by Laughlin and Warners and subject matter designed to entice the enormous alienated youth audience, this uncontroversial film is for justice and equality, yoga, the creative arts, meditation, role play therapy, wild horses, and gun control. It is against bigotry, bullies, child beaters, and formal education. It became a phenomenon at the box office. The eerie part is that its nonviolent audience most enjoyed the violence perpetrated by Billy Jack on the conservative types who are threatening the children at pacifist Taylor's school. When he catches that guy between the eyes, man, it is pretty satisfying. Ah, that's amazing. It's particularly disturbing when the kids of in the film give Billy Jack a power salute, signifying that he is their savior. It reminds me of how Nazi youth responded to Hitler. It's clear that Laughlin wanted viewers to think of him and his character as one and the same. Picture isn't badly made. That's not a real compliment. Picture isn't badly made. Hapkido scenes are exciting. Taylor gives a very moving account of what it feels like to be raped, and Laughlin makes a good, charismatic action hero. However, it is pretentious and badly flawed. For instance, townspeople are won over to school's virtues by watching comedy routine by adult improv group, The Committee, rather than by seeing children live, learn, and create things at the school. Debate between Laughlin and Taylor regarding violence versus pacifism is never resolved, and the picture's major theme, that the disenchanted youths of America have an ally in the Indian, is weak because Laughlin never defines being an Indian, although this is Billy Jack's goal. One Tin Soldier is sung by Coven. Sequels: The Trial of Billy Jack, Billy Jack Goes to Washington. Laughlin began another sequel in 1986. Oh, man. Also with Clark Howatt, Bert Fried, Julie Webb, Kenneth Toby, Howard Hessman.
Okay, so more than ever, like, this is always the question that I want to start with, but really in this case, Nathan, what is it about Billy Jack that leapt out at you from the entirety of all of the movies in the Guide for the Film Fanatic that made you want to talk about it with us tonight?
Well, I think what I find kind of fascinating about it is that it is utterly, utterly original.
Well said. Grand,
sort of surreal combination of elements. I feel like there's like a 50-minute, like, fairly conventional action movie about, you know, sort of this badass Aztec maverick, and he stands up for the oppressed, you know, these figures of the establishment. But the rest of it is terrible folk songs about peace and the committee. There's like an Indian ceremony. There's a Mustang ride. Again, it's just sort of like Tom Laughlin, almost like outsider art. It's so weird and so unconventional. You look like Born Losers, like, that's a fairly conventional, biker film, sort of a revenge film, sort of a exploitation movie. And then that was successful, and then every with the more and more success, he got more and more ambitious and more pretentious and more convinced that Billy Jack could save the world. Like, it became kind of this delirium. And the other thing that's kind of fascinating to this is, like, he worked in education before that, and this is kind of a 2-hour long infomercial for Montessori.
Yes, very much so.
And again, the other thing that really, really fascinates me is that this love letter to the counterculture by the squarest man in the world.
Right. I mean, when we're talking about this movie and what makes it interesting and what makes it compelling and what makes it worth watching is really almost every conversation boils down to tension. Like, it is a movie of incredible tension. It is the story of a soft-spoken peacenik protecting pacifists with violence. It is it is an artsy youth movie and an exploitation picture. Like, it's got all of these elements that are just sort of wildly incongruent, but they're existing at the same time. And clearly it was something that people in 1971 through 1973, through its various releases, were responding to. And I'm curious why you think that is. All I could come up with was the idea that sort of Easy Rider is kind of a precedent for this, that it also is sort of a cross between like an art film and an exploitation picture. You know, the youth market is
Has very stereotypical characters that are really easy to understand. That's a good point.
Totally. You know, and famously, that was a movie that came out and, you know, and made a shitload of money and showed that there was this market to be served. But I don't know. I really do feel like that tension, those various levels of tension throughout the thing are would sink most movies. And for some reason, they're what make this one so compelling. I don't know. Where do you land on that?
Well, one of the things that I find utterly fascinating about this as well is basically 4 decades or 3 decades after this movie was made, there was an unofficial remake called Avatar. Avatar was the most successful movie of all time. And you go back and look at it now, and like, why on earth did this like crazy, weird, incredibly earnest sort of peacenik environmental, you know, like, we must be one with the natives.
And, and
like, this man who goes native. And again, this, I don't want to just disillusion you guys, but Tom Laughlin wasn't an actual Native American.
What?
I'm doing this Stephen King project on my Substack, Nathan Rubin's Bad Ideas, and one of the last films that I saw for it is a little movie called Firestarter.
Ah, yes.
I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it has this wonderful wonderful Native American actor George C. Scott.
Yes, exactly.
playing the character of John Rainbird, also a kind of a Vietnam veteran, Cherokee, who spends an hour befriending Drew Barrymore. It's kind of fascinating to see how many Indian movies are aggressively, aggressively non. And it was kind of nice that the only way that like the 2022 version improves upon it, other than John Carpenter did the score, is that you have an actual Native American actor.
Imagine that.
Who doesn't spend the whole time befriending a small child.
Right.
And I think that's, and again, I love George C. Scott. You know, he's one of the all-time greats, but he has no business playing a Native American. And Tom Laughlin also did not really have any business playing a Native American.
This is the wild thing about the 70s, though, is that like a lot of the sort of well-known or symbols of Native Americans in that era turned out to not have, Suchie Littlefeather was not actually a Native American.
Iron Eyes Cody.
Cody was where I was going next. Also not a Native American. So, you know, that's he wasn't alone in that, certainly. But that is
he's the crying because you littered guy.
Yes, okay. He is.
Yeah.
But you're right that is another sort of piece of this weird jigsaw puzzle that did sort of, you know, that piped into something that was very present in the counterculture in the 70s, was this sort of lifting up / maybe exoticizing of the Native American and the Native American experience.
Wait, you guys, is Kevin Costner not Indian either?
you won't believe this, but no. So all of that stuff is fascinating, and then on top of all of that, then it takes this turn in the middle to third act of the the rape revenge movie. Like suddenly it takes on that sort of venerable exploitation standby and goes with that. Do you think, as someone who has viewed this movie and thought about it for a long time, Nathan, was this just a everything but the kitchen sink approach? What is, to your eyes, what is Tom Laughlin's sort of guiding principle as an artist, as a filmmaker, as manifested in this, his sort of definitive statement to that time?
Well, I think part of what makes this really interesting, what makes him really interesting, is how incredibly personal all of this is. Like, he means this.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Even like the Hapkido, like, he was really into it. He wanted to spread that. I think that's another kind of reason why this was so successful, is you didn't see a lot of martial arts in movies before this.
Oh, that's real.
You had your Bruce Lee, you know, but that's, I mean, Enter the Dragon is, you know, in between this whole time. There.
Yeah,
so I think to see this guy kicking these, you know, corny ass square establishment dudes in the face, that was very exciting for them. I think it's just kind of an example, like, everything that he thought was interesting and should be in a movie, whether or not it has any business being in a movie.
Right.
And there's like, this is a halfway towards being a musical.
Right.
You know, and that's kind of good. Like, there are all these like folk songs, and it's obviously like, these children are so beautiful and they sing of peace and justice. And it's like
the worst. It's almost like there is good folk music, but you wouldn't know it if this
and again, there's this just fascinating combination of feigned hipness and incredible squareness.
Right.
For example, Renee Taylor, whose character, again, she was not an actress before this. If I remember correctly, the actress from the attractive young hippie woman from War of Losers was supposed to reappear in this movie, the female lead. And then in a shocking turn of events, she had difficulty working with Tom Laughlin.
Really?
Actually, if you want to go way, way back, Robert Altman's first narrative film starred a guy named Tom Laughlin.
Sure did.
In a shocking turn of events, Robert Altman and Tom Laughlin Did not get along, really. So again, I think Tom Hoffman is like the only person who can put up with me is me and my wife and people that and these like teenagers and college students that I paid
and the four fictional names that he used to the four fictional people he made up to also to direct and co-write and produce the movie.
I read a self-published book about the making of these movies.
Did you?
And it was one very much from the kind of perspective of them. And they would talk about things like, the helicopter shots and how like they added production values. And I gotta say, I liked this a lot more than I did the previous time. In part because it's so weird, but also because having seen the trial of Billy Jack, which again, three and a half hours long, and Billy Jack Goes to Washington, which is a remake of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Correct.
But with Billy Jack.
With Billy Jack.
This is so much. And this is the jewel of the Billy Jack series. And you just have these crazier and crazier ideas.
Right.
At one point, he was on Kickstarter in the aughts, that he was going to make a Billy Jack movie. And Billy Jack was going to debate George W. Bush about the Iraq War.
I will put in the show notes. There is a New York Times article from when he was trying to put that together, and he's not a well man. These are not the quotes of a sane human being. So I will put that in the show notes.
And the other thing that's really fascinating, because I was sort of researching this pretty extensively. I wrote a very weird novel where this takes place fairly prominently, but there was also an actual reboot that a studio would have financed with Keanu Reeves as the son of Billy Jack.
Sure.
And Tom Laughlin got paid $1 million by, some studio. And at this point, he's like, I'm friggin' 80 years old. Like, what the hell? Billy Jack hasn't been a presence in him. And the thing that I find really fascinating, it was such a huge hit. It was like a pop culture phenomenon. It captured the cultural zeitgeist. It's this low budget, weird movie with like a semi no star.
Right.
And it's been weirdly forgotten.
Yeah.
I feel like weirdos like me and Richardson, who has a Billy Jack tattoo. there was a wrestler in the 1980s called Billy Jack.
Sure.
And Hillshank was just basically like, I stole that character. And I think he was sued by Tom Laughlin.
Of course.
Bit of a cranky, crusty fellow.
Exactly.
And like, even in like the bad movie world, like you don't hear this talked about.
Right.
Like, this hasn't been on like Flophouse or We Hate Movies or How Did This Get Made? Because it has this weird invisibility for a movie that was so incredibly
successful.
And so incredibly and influential as well. You kind of talked about it changed the way that movies were distributed and marketed sort of forever. And it outgrossed all of these, movies with huge directors and huge stars and big budgets. It's kind of this crazy underdog project. And I would love it if Alexander and Karaziski would make a movie about this, because it's so compelling and so weird and so kind of a piece with the other movies that they've written, Leo Gadwood and My Name is Dolomite. It's I find this movie endlessly fascinating. And I gotta say, like, this time, like, Tom Laughlin, he's a pretty compelling, if I can groove this peer here, he's got real charisma. And I think part of it is that he doesn't talk a lot in this movie.
Right.
And in the trial,
in the follow-ups, not so much.
Huh? Oh my god, he never stops talking. It's like 90% talking, and then eventually kicks somebody in the face. And it's like, we want the face kicking. We don't want the and he kind of has this sort of Clint Eastwood, sort of stoic, sort of internal sort of man who, keeps everything to himself. And the music
is
really
the smarter play. Like, One Tin Soldier was a huge, huge hit. Like, that's...
And one of the many wonderfully weird elements of this movie is that the band, the folky hippie band that recorded One Tin Soldier, were Satanists.
Of course.
They were not called Coven for nothing. They worshipped Satan, and somehow, the band that made this incredibly infectious sort of earworm with this incredibly corny, cheesy, hippie message. Yeah. They worship the Dark Lord. Which again, I think at least one interesting scene, you know, in the movie about the making of this.
Yeah, yeah, fascinating. It's a bizarre movie. It's a butt kicking movie. It's a folk singing movie. There's lots of improvisational comedy, and I appreciated its faithfulness to the improv theater experience because the improv scenes are often rambling and muddy and not terribly good. Howard Essman.
Howard Essman, yeah. And he's genuinely, and again, just the weirdness where, you know, Dolores Tucker was the entire rap version there. She also would be interesting to make a movie about.
Sure.
But Dolores Taylor, you know, she's sort of talking about the school that's kind of a paradise. You know, it's kind of this dream. It's sort of the hippie dream realized in school form. And it like doesn't seem to have anything to do with like actual school.
Oh, certainly.
You know?
Not.
It's just like, oh, it's a great school. You can do a painting. You can be a mime. You can, you know, grow a flower. I'm like, these are all nice things. Like,
none of them are really education
based. Like reading or going to school or like grades or things like that.
Yes.
But again, I guess just this idea of youth and the counterculture and education and different kinds of education. That like the education that people have is, you know, it's tired, it's exhausted, it's part of the old world.
Exactly.
And this new way of doing it. And I love the fact that she's like, there were like three, a very, very fascinating presence. Because she's not an actress, she was kind of like this waif who I'm sure was totally dominated by her incredibly domineering and egotistical husband.
Okay, well, let's take a quick break and then we will talk about the movie's release and reception. All right, friends, let's talk about the release and reception of Billy Jack, which initially, and we'll, since we have multiple ones to choose from, which initially opened on New York on July 28th, 1971. So we'll go with that one. Also released on that day, On Any Sunday, Von Richthofen and Brown, The Go-Between and Bless the Beasts and Children. And also in theaters in NYC that weekend, Little Big Man, Shaft, Death in Venice, Plaza Suite, Drive, He Said, Willard, The Anderson Tapes, The Touch, The Panic in Needle Park, The Devils, Bananas, Clute, Carnal Knowledge, and Russ Meyer's The 7 Minutes. Mike, what were the news headlines on that day?
That was a weird list, man. It's usually like things we've heard of, but that was sort of an off-brand list. Interesting.
Some that we've heard of, some that we haven't, some that only you have seen, like Russ Meyer's The 7 Minutes.
That's fair.
Put that in there just for you.
I enjoyed it. Okay. The United States. What are we talking about here? July 28th, 1971. The United States announced that it would discontinue further airplane surveillance flights over the People's Republic of China after years of flying SR-71 spy planes and sending unmanned reconnaissance drones into Chinese airspace. So we agreed to stop spying on the Chinese on this day, or at least we announced that we had agreed to stop spying on the Chinese.
We're just going to have to take... I mean, we'll take our government's word for it, which was something it was very safe to do in 1971, if I recall correctly.
You could always trust Nixon, you know?
It's true.
He just had a very trustworthy face. Him and Agnew. You're like, I just trust those guys.
I do.
They just seem honest.
Hasn't been an issue ever since.
Yep.
So shout out to 1971. Yep. Unfortunately, this is the day Diane Arbus was found dead of suicide.
Oh.
They think she had done it a couple days earlier, but she was found on this day. So if you don't know any... thing about Diane Arbus, you should go look at her work. She's a photographer, and it's great, great stuff. So,
or
just shout out to Diane.
Poorly received biopic for her.
That's true.
Let's go. And there's, I want to read a couple of quotes from the Times. They're actually talking about a little place in Seattle. And for one thing, it's sort of weird when the New York Times talks about Seattle. But also, this is a fascinating story about a place called Pike's Peak Market. And it's a farmer's market. Pike Place. I mean, it says, quote, "It was the farmers who made the market, one of the few left in the country where they sell their own produce. So this is 1971, and they're talking about farmers markets as this thing that is basically like a nearly extinct beast, right?
Okay.
50 years ago, 500 of them would roll into town on summer's day and pay the city 10 cents for a stall. Now Boeing and other industries have expanded into the surrounding countryside, gobbling up much of the rich farmland that produced a dazzling array of greens, beans, peas, squash, turnips, radishes. Now, if you've ever been to Pike's Place Public Market in Seattle, there is no farmland for 100 miles in any direction. So just that by itself is sort of fascinating. Sure. But at this moment, they were about to tear down the market. It had been built in 1907. And this story is about the community coming together to say, let's not tear down the market. We understand that you can't necessarily continue to grow tomatoes in downtown Seattle, but let's keep the market, please. And as it's basically a tourist location at this point, like it's not like people from Seattle are going there to shop, but like, have you ever heard of a farmer's market? Yeah, you have, bro. Yeah, you have, you know? Yeah. And I think that like, in some ways, this story and like, just because I was watching Billy Jack as I was reading this, and it just all really felt of a piece. And it's so easy to feel like 1971 was like this thing that just happened and then went away. But it's actually not. There's so many things that you know, that they were sort of arguing for at this silly school. Like, you know, they were like, you know, they were probably the only people in the whole area that weren't homophobic, just for instance.
Right.
There are so many things that actually we did benefit from.
Right.
Even though the representation of it was all so silly. And it's just jumped out to me in that moment. Thank you for saving Pike Place Market. And thank you for making farmers markets real. And I don't like a lot of the people that probably did that, but I'm glad they did it anyway. That's the news. Jason, what did the critics say about Billy Jack?
Howard Thompson of the New York Times wrote that the picture, quote, works none too well. Noting the violence commences to pile on predictably and endlessly with an assortment of town bullies and psychopaths right out of Western stereotypes. As for the folks out at the school, which often amounts to a stockade, they certainly are a genial, harmless bunch bent on doing their own thing. But some of their guitar whimpering is terrible. And several of those now pantomimes meant to be amusing are too cute for words. The whole picture nicely conveys a Southwestern atmosphere, but much too often at the cost of plain credibility, it stacks its cards, characters, and even credo like any rootin' tootin' Western, end quote. Roger Ebert gave it 2.5 out of 4 stars in the Chicago Sun-Times, writing, quote, there are a lot of things in Billy Jack that are seriously conceived and very well handled. Some of the scenes at the school, for example, with real kids experimenting with psychodrama are interesting. Some of the action scenes are first rate. There's a lot of dialogue, mostly involving put down of the older generation. But the movie has as many causes in it as a year's run of The New Republic. There's not a single contemporary issue from a ecology to gun control that's not covered, and towards the movie's end, you're wondering how these characters, who are just ordinary folks in a small Southwestern town, manage to confront every single ethical hurdle in a few weeks of living. It's possible, I guess, but it will keep you awfully busy, end quote. Gary Arnold, writing for the Washington Post, called Billy Jack, quote, horrendously self-righteous and devious, explaining every social issue is dramatized in terms of absolute apolitical good and evil. The good guys are next to angelic, while the bad guys are, according to the needs of the moment, utter buffoons or utter devils. Anyone with the slightest trace of skepticism or sophistication would tend to reject the movie out of hand, and with good reason, since this kind of simplification is dramatically and socially deceitful.
I gotta push back on that a little, though, because Billy Jack himself is forever like, you know, I know you guys don't want me to be violent, but what am I supposed to do? Like, there's constant pushback around his violence. Right. And there's also the sheriff character who keeps letting these guys do all this stuff, but it's clear that he doesn't like it, that he's not participating in it. You know, he doesn't want to rock the boat in a way. But, and you know, at some point that can start to seem a little bit like, oh, like, where is your line? Do you actually have a line? Or is this just like a theoretical line that actually, you know, there's no real hard. But like, I have to say, like, that's, I don't think that's fair. There is obviously some cartoonish good guys and bad guys, the kid with the car, you know, there's right, but not everybody in it.
There
does
are some
that.
Nuance.
Also,
yeah.
Have you met the kid with the fucking the 17-year-old with that car? That kid.
I
sucks.
Sure have.
Kind of
he
sucks
sure
in a real black and white kind of way. I mean, he that sure wouldn't even bother me.
Yeah. In the Los Angeles Times, the reliably thoughtful exploitation movie critic Kevin Thomas praised the, quote, searing tension that sustains it through careening unevenness to a smash finish. Crude and sensational, yet urgent and pertinent, this provocative Warner's release is in its unique, awkward way, one of the year's most important pictures, end quote. How did it do in terms of box office and awards, Mike?
You are not going to believe it after the way we've been talking about this movie the whole time. But between its original 1971 release and the 1973 re-release, it grossed $32 million on a budget of $800,000. That's like porno numbers. Mm-hmm. Making it one of porno in 1971 numbers. I mean.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Making
yeah.
it one of the most profitable independent films of all time, as well as the second highest grossing movie of 1971 behind only Fiddler on the Roof. That's bananas.
Oh my God.
For an yep. independent film? I mean, yep. how many versions of that story even are there?
Yeah, yeah. Like that Halloween Blair Witch. That's pretty much it.
You know what I mean, right?
Yeah.
That's
yeah, yeah,
incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
It was
normal activity.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a hit that another Billy Jack movie was inevitable. And in 1974, Laughlin and Taylor made the direct sequel, The Trial of Billy Jack, which was also a commercial success. It made $31 million and came in fifth for the year. No wonder he had an attitude. Outgrossing the likes of Death Wish and this is true, The Godfather Part II. Billy Jack.
Yeah. Yeah.
But his next outing, a combination Billy Jack sequel and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington remake called, predictably, Billy Jack Goes to Washington, was a notorious flop, barely released in theaters and marking the end of the franchise. Laughlin and Taylor made two more attempts to resurrect the character in the mid-80s and mid-aughts, but without success. Laughlin died in 2013. It was nominated for two awards of note. Dolores Taylor got a Golden Globe nomination for Most Promising Newcomer Female, and Tom Laughlin was for, and I promise this is true, the NAACP Image Award for Outstanding Actor in a Motion Picture.
Yeah, didn't win, but got that nomination for the Image Award. That's such a surreal touch that it feels like it could only be associated with this movie. Now it's time for a segment.
I don't
we
even
call
know what to say about that.
I don't either. So we move on. Now it's time for a segment we call Double It Up, where we select one movie that we think would make an ideal double feature with today's focal film. Nathan, you're our guest, which means you go first.
Well, I'm going to cheat on this one because I've seen The Trial of Billy Jack and I want to talk about it because I've spent, I don't know, 7, 10, 15 hours just singing the craziness. And this ends in a way it's like, you know, again, the Black Power salute
for
Billy Jack. And he's like, oh, I need to go on trial and then I will tell everybody my story and I can be as didactic as a motherfucker.
Yep.
I can just be a front page news dude. And it reminded me of Joker Folie à Deux. Which then really was like, oh, what are you gonna do with the sequel? He's gonna freaking be in jail? He's gonna be on trial? Is that what you're gonna do? It's like, yeah, just as a screw you to all of the fans.
Right.
Like, this is gonna be a weird musical and it's going to be him. Because again, if there's something that Joker fans love, they love musicals and
they
love courtroom dramas.
Of course.
And if there's something that Billy Jack fans love, they love musicals. This is kind of a musical. And the sequel is totally a. And then also, I feel like this has a certain kinship to Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. Speaking of the NAACP Image Award, where again, it's just this man who. Actor, it's like I just can't deal with the studio system. It's killing me. It won't allow me to be myself. I need to express my vision and my voice, and the people will resonate. Like I'll make the weirdest, artiest, craziest avant-garde fucking movie, and it'll gross $50 billion and like create Black Split and pop as well. I mean, look at Melvin Van Peebles. Like I'd say as a musician, right, as much, if not more so, as a storyteller and a film actor and a director and all of these things. And again, you just talk about these sort of new Hollywood miracles.
Yeah.
That these very eccentric, very ambitious, who just have this incredible drive and this, yep, resilience, and Hollywood told them no 100 times. And they said, "Screw you, Hollywood. We're going to make our movie anyway, and people are going to flip over it, and it's going to make $1 billion, and it's somehow going to like capture the zeitgeist." So yeah, I think those would be two good next steps if you don't want to go to Trial of Billy Jack, which again, I think, yeah, is worth seeing just because it is so completely, and because it's 10 times. Preachier and more, sure, didactic and talky than this. Yep. You know, I think this is, you know, sort of an action movie with some speechifying. That is 3 hours of speechifying with a little bit of action thrown in.
They flipped the formula. I thought long and hard about this because you're right. There are not a lot of movies like this one that you can pinpoint. I think Sweet Sweetback is brilliant. I went with a much more recent movie. I went with Rebel Ridge, Jeremy Saulnier's movie from a couple years back.
Good call, buddy.
You know, it's a guy coming to a town as opposed to a guy who's around the town, but in a lot of the same ways. The things that are most satisfying about Billy Jack, i.e. watching rednecks get the shit kicked out of them, are very much present in Rebel Ridge. And the social commentary is threaded a bit more finally. Mike, what is your pick
for a very well feature? Good call, dude. The Rebel Thank Ridge you. Is a good call for that. Would be a nice, these two would go well together. I think I was trying to think about a palate cleanser because I got to the end of Billy Jack and I needed a palate cleanser. And I think you have to go hard. I think you have to go hard to palate cleanse Billy Jack. I think you got to go El Topo and really, okay, really,
no, that's a good one. That's a good one.
Wrench your mind back, yeah, into, you know, a much more abstract place. And then at the end of that, you'll come out more sort of balanced. Mm. So, yeah, I think El Topo. And if you haven't seen it, then fuck, I'm not telling you about it. I don't just fuck it up. Just go.
You have a surprise in store. Yeah, that's what you have. Nathan, the book again. Hold on. Let me make sure I'm framing it just right. The book again. See, why do I have weird focal issues? Fucking Zoom.
Focal issues. It's because you have the stuff around your face blurred.
There we go.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I put it right on my face. There you go. Everybody can see it. There we go. The book is The Fractured Mirror, Nathan Raven's Happy Places Definitive Guide to American Movies About Filmmaking, and it is out now. Where is the best place? I always like to ask other authors this. Where's the best place?
They gave your name the shadow font, bro. Like, they gave your name action font. That's pretty cool. Great. That's awesome. You know, that's a good cover.
Yeah. My illustrator and my book did, and they're both geniuses. But I encourage you to purchase the book from me personally, signed. You can go to my website, nathanraven.com/shop. My sister-in-law revamped the whole thing.
There we go.
And I don't want to give him to Jeff Bezos because he's an evil motherfucker.
There you go.
And he has more money than he ever needs. So yeah, I encourage you to buy it directly from me or from some sort of independent bookstore, last resort, Amazon, who I
there discovered
are way better at selling books than I am, I and consequently have slightly more money.
They do. We will put a link to that in the show notes. But yes, by all means, buy it directly from Nathan. Where can people follow you on social media and read your work?
Oh, sure. I'm on Blue Sky. I'm Nathan Raven on there. I'm on Threads, also Nathan Raven. I'm on X/Twitter. I don't want to be on X or Twitter. I'm doing a Kickstarter, God willing, in the very near future for my first novel, which is a Freddy Got Fingered themed parody of Five Nights at Freddy's.
There we go.
Called Five Nights at Freddy Got Fingered. It's kind of inspired by my son's momentary obsession with Five Nights at Freddy's, and I'm like, this is the stupidest movie that I've ever seen. Like, it's so ridiculous, and it's kind of like with Billy Jack, where it's fucking bonkers. I'm like, oh, well, the kids will love this movie about the evil ghost children who inhabit the animatronics.
Yes.
But they're all being brainwashed by the evil serial killer who runs Chuck E. Cheese or something. And it made $300 million.
It did. It
made $300 million just by being terrible and like being available on Peacock.
Yes.
The day that it came out. And then Billy Jack figures fairly prominently in that. One of the themes in the book is that, well, an alternate universe in which Freddy Got Fingered is the most successful film ever made.
Sure.
And Tom Green is sort of like this J.D. Salinger, like recluse, and he has these animatronics like go and do promotional tours for him, and yeah, some of them turn out to be evil. And Rip Torn and an evil Rip Torn animatronic figure very prominently,
of course.
And after Tom Green becomes the most successful filmmaker in the world, Steven Spielberg wants to work with him, wants to give him like a 10-picture deal, you know, limitless budget, I'll be your executive producer. Uh-huh. And he's like, no, the only person that I want to work with is Tom Laughlin.
There we go.
And I want to be the new Billy Jack.
There we go.
My wife was copy editing it, and she somehow cut out that entire part of the book, almost as if it's self-indulgent and
yes,
people won't understand it. Uh-huh. So yeah, God willing, the Kickstarter for Five Nights at Freddy Got Fingered will be up, and then to release it on Halloween, because it's got more mainstream appeal than anything I've ever done. My first novel in my 10th book.
So there we
I'm
go.
Pretty excited about that.
There we go. All right.
Oh, and then my Substack, yes, Nathan Ribbon's Bad Ideas.
There we
go. And my website, Nathan Ribbon, Happy Place.
I'm Jason Dash Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. Mike, where can people find you?
I'm Michael Hull on Letterboxd, where I'm going to write about El Topo, I think.
I'm sure you will. Of course, if you like the show and think other people might like it too, please do leave us a rating and or a review on your podcatcher of choice. If you'd like to join our mailing list and get weekly show notes and links that we've mentioned throughout, you can do that at buttondown.email/filmfanatic. If you'd like to make a donation to support us in the show, you can do that at ko-fi.com/funcitysounds. And of course, if you're one of the very peculiar people who likes to watch videos of people while talking into microphones, hello, we have a YouTube channel. It's Guy for the Film Fanatic, and you can watch the show there.
Our humblest thanks to our guiding light, Mr. Danny Perry, author of Guide for the Film Fanatic, and shout out to executive producer Blake Howard. You know, yeah, Blake keeps so busy. I asked him the other day how he has time to produce and host all these shows, and he said, being a podcaster is not a matter of blood. It's a way of life.
Thank you again, Nathan Rabin.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. Always
thank
a
you.
Pleasure to talk, Jack.
Always, always. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening. On the next Guide for the Film Fanatic, Ashley Clark, author of The World of Black Film, joins us to discuss the rip-roaring reggae gangster classic, The Harder They Come. See you then.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.